Hello, folks. This is the second lecture on the Primer Book. Again, the Primer Book is a PDF which is attached to the blog. We will, in addition, be talking about critical realism. Critical realism is another PDF file which is attached to the blog. They are both under section 1 of the blog. If you go to the blog, you will see both of those listed under section 1. But first we'll start out with the Primer Book, continuing where we left off last time, and discuss theory. What is theory in a general sense? We will discuss one theory today, and then we will conclude our discussion of theory as well as our discussion of Chapter 1 on, in the next lecture. As a note, we will not be discussing the research methods part of Chapter 1. We will only be talking about the theory part of Chapter 1. Okay, theory. What is it? Theory is scientific explanation. That is true, whether you are talking about theory in sociology, in biology, in chemistry, in psychology, in physics, in political science, in economics, whatever. Theory is scientific explanation. The idea that there is one scientific method is not true. There are many scientific methods. Now, unfortunately, in the United States, we have a very narrow view of what is science, which is rather unique in the world. The word science comes from a Latin word which means knowledge. The German word for science is Wissenschaft. Wissenschaft comes from the word Wissen, which means knowledge. The Arabic word for science is Ilm. Ilm also means knowledge. In the United States, for some reason, we have developed this very narrow view that science somehow has to conform to certain specific principles. And so people get into debates over what is and what is not science. That is not something that we do in sociology in general, and it is not something that we do in the sociology of social problems. We don't worry about those kinds of things. The view of science, which I have and which many people have, is the more European view. For example, in Britain, they talk about the human sciences. The human sciences include what we call in the United States the social sciences, including sociology, the biological sciences, the physical sciences like physics. But the human sciences also includes the humanities, such as English literature, languages in general, philosophy, and a variety of other fields as well, which in the U.S. we generally would not refer to as science. So whereas we in the U.S. look at science in a very narrow way, most people in the world view it in a very broad way. Now, that said, theory, more specifically, if you ever hear anybody making the statement, it's just a theory, you know that that person does not know what theory is. If somebody says, everyone has their own theory, you know that that person does not know what theory is. If you hear somebody say, who's to say which theory is better? Again, you know that that person does not know what theory is. Theory, in a sense, is the same as science or knowledge. Theory is science or knowledge. It is the knowledge which is collected by engaging in research and which is turned into a kind of systematic study or a kind of organization of knowledge. So theory is the way in which knowledge is organized in a particular field or discipline. That is theory. And when you have that knowledge, then you are capable of explaining whatever it is that particular science tries to explain. In the case of sociology, that is society, culture, groups, organizations, and all social phenomena together. So theory is literally the highest level of sophistication in science. Theory is higher than laws, hypotheses, or concepts. A law, like the law of gravity, is a hypothesis which has been supported over and over and over again, so that basically nobody doubts it anymore. For example, the law of gravity. We all know that any object dropped in a vacuum will fall at a constant rate of approximately 32 feet per second squared. That is gravity. When people say that Isaac Newton discovered gravity, that is what he discovered, that any object in a vacuum, doesn't matter how big or small or what its mass is, its weight is, any object in a vacuum will fall at a constant rate of 32 feet per second squared. That's a law because it happens all the time. There are no exceptions to it. But if you ask about the various laws that Newton developed, including the first and second laws of thermodynamics, such as inertia, an object in motion remains in motion unless repelled by another force, all of those laws are a part of mechanistic or Newtonian physics, which are names given to Isaac Newton's theory of physics. So a law is, again, a hypothesis which has been supported repeatedly. A concept is something like water. Now, water is not a particularly useful concept. If I say water, you might say, well, do you mean tap water? Do you mean salt water? Do you mean fluoridated water? Do you mean chlorinated water? And so on. Just saying water is not very informative. But if I say pure H2O, meaning two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen, that is a very specific statement. Water is a concept. H2O is a variable. a variable is a concept which can be measured. In studying theories, we need to study them by taking concepts and turning them into variables. Then, when we connect variables together, often in the form of if-then statements, if this occurs, then that will occur. Then we have a hypothesis. And again, if that hypothesis, over many years, studied by many, many people, is supported, we call that hypothesis a law. So laws, hypotheses, and concepts are all parts of theory. So whereas most people look at theory as the ground level, as the bottom level of science, scientists look at theory as the highest level of science, or even as science itself. Okay, so that's a general definition of science from a scientific perspective, and it's something that I assume anybody, whether in a social science, biological, physical science, whatever, would agree with. That's just a simple definition of theory. Now what we will do is we will begin to go through several different theories that are used in sociology. We will start with one which is not in the book, but again, which is in that PDF file, which, like the book, is connected to the blog. And it's the PDF file on critical realism. If you have not yet read that, my suggestion is to pause this MP3 file, listen, or read rather, the PDF on critical realism, and then begin listening to what I am about to say. Okay, so I'm assuming now that you have all read through that PDF file on critical realism, which is linked from the blog. Let's go through what critical realism refers to. First, critical realism was developed by the late John Bhaskar. Bhaskar just died back in the early, about 2010, 2011, something like that. He was quite young when he died. He was only 70. He had a chronic condition, which at one point resulted in part of his leg being amputated. It was not diabetes, which is what a person might think. I don't remember the name of his condition. It has a long, long name to it. But he was quite sick for a while, and eventually he just could not, his body could not sustain itself, and he died at 70 years old, sadly. He was a great man, and he made tremendous contributions to sociology, to philosophy, and to other fields. Bhaskar himself was a philosopher, but many critical realists are sociologists. And I would say that critical realism, in a sense, is more sociological than it is philosophical. A lot of sociological theories were actually developed by philosophers, people who were philosophers in training, not just critical realism. Okay, so what is critical realism? In a general sense, one might say that critical realism is a theory which attempts to explain how one might go about establishing libertarian communism. Now, what is libertarian communism? In the United States, when most people hear the word libertarian or libertarianism, they think of right-wing libertarianism, like Ron Paul, perhaps his son, Rand Paul, perhaps the former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, various people on the right who call themselves libertarians. Libertarianism, in the American sense of the term, was developed by people such as Murray Rothbard, who were conservatives. In many cases, they were billionaires. And basically, their idea was that they supported capitalism, the so-called free market. But they had nothing against people doing what they wanted to do. So, in terms of morality, they were non-judgmental. So, most, but not all, right-wing libertarians in the United States would not place judgments on people's moral behavior. Many support, for example, an elimination of the criminalization of drug use, the complete decriminalization of drug use, because they have no problem with any of those kinds of things. They believe in liberty. But they also believe in what they call economic liberty, which really is just pure capitalism, the so-called free market, where capitalists can do what they want, they can make as much money as they want, often at the expense of workers. That's right-wing libertarianism. It's basically a justification for free market capitalism plus an acceptance of somewhat progressive views on moral issues. Now, before there was Murray Rothbard's right-wing libertarianism, there was libertarian communism. And there are a variety of figures, including Rosa Luxemburg, who are associated with libertarian communism. Libertarian communism can be found both in Marxism, the ideas of Karl Marx, which we'll talk about in a bit, in the next lecture, and Rosa Luxemburg, who was also a Marxist. But then there's also, in anarchism, there's also a kind of anarchist communism, sometimes called anarcho-communism, which is a more anarchist approach to libertarian communism. So there are Marxist forms of libertarian communism, and there are anarchist forms of libertarian communism. Roy Bhaskar was a Marxist, not an anarchist. So his idea was, how can we establish a libertarian communist society? By that he meant a society in which there is no capitalism and there is true freedom. By true freedom, what he meant was freedom from oppression, freedom from racism, from sexism, from ageism, from ableism, the oppression of the disabled, freedom from nationalism, the oppression of one nation by another, and so on. That all of these different types of oppression would gradually go away. That's the basic idea of libertarian communism, especially as it was explained by Roy Bhaskar. And then ultimately, you would reach the condition of pure libertarian communism, where there would be no capitalists, that everyone would own the means of production, meaning you would not have a capitalist owning a factory the workers would own the factory. Libertarian communism is also distinguished by its belief in communism from below, meaning that communism must be established by the masses. So there's no dictatorship like what happens in the former Soviet Union or in Cuba or any place else, or in North Korea perhaps. There's no dictatorship. It's purely a mass movement where the workers themselves are the owners, and there are absolutely no capitalists. So that's what Roy Bhaskar believed. Now, you can say that critical realism is a theory developed by Roy Bhaskar on how we can establish a libertarian communist society and also eliminate other types of oppression that we mentioned, such as racism and sexism and classism and ageism and ableism. Okay, so that's a general idea of what critical realism is. It is a theory, but it's also a method, in a sense, of establishing a libertarian communist society. Now, there are a few different versions of critical realism, which Roy Bhaskar, using the common academic term, called turns. Turns, T-U-R-N-S. Like I turn in this direction, I turn in that direction, then I turn in that direction. In academia, we look at those as stages in an academic's life. Like I can look at various turns in my own life, where I've made slight turns here, turn there, based on new knowledge. I may turn in another direction at some other point in time. Roy Bhaskar had a few of these. The first major turn of Roy Bhaskar is now referred to as basic critical realism. Basic critical realism. And we'll talk about two major aspects of this. First is the concept of the real, the actual, and the empirical. Okay. The real refers to the causal mechanisms which make things happen. The actual refers to the events which are caused by those causal mechanisms. The empirical refers to the researcher's observation of those events. Give you an example, a non-sociological example. Nobody has ever seen gravity, including Newton. We don't know what gravity looks like. There are debates on what gravity is, whether it's a kind of magnetism or something else. Again, no one has ever seen gravity. So how do we know that gravity exists? We know that it exists by what it does, which is the actual. Again, going back to what I said before, that an object in a vacuum of any size, weight, or mass will fall at a constant rate of approximately 32 feet per second squared. That is what we are observing. In other words, we are not observing gravity, which nobody knows what it is or what it looks like. We are observing what gravity does. You know, what it actually does. The observation part is the empirical part. That's me. Me observing what actually happens. Let's use a more sociological example. I am speaking now in the midst of COVID-19. Maybe you are listening at a time in the future when the coronavirus has passed. I hope so. But COVID-19 is still very much a reality, especially here in the United States, where we have not really dealt with that virus very well. Now, we can talk about the term pandemic. Well, what's a pandemic? Presumably there is such a thing as a pandemic, but nobody has ever seen it. We can't see a pandemic. We can talk about it, but we can't really see it. There's apparently some structure, some certain mechanisms that make up a pandemic, but I don't know what they are. What we can see is what the pandemic does, that it's killing people, that people are dying. People are having long-term after effects from COVID-19. That is the actual. So the pandemic is the real. The results of the pandemic are the actual. And then me as an individual observing the actual, observing the results of that pandemic, the deaths, for example, that is the empirical. Okay? So any social problem like COVID-19 can be looked at using that three-level system. The real, which are the causal mechanisms, the actual, which are the actual events caused by those mechanisms that we observe, and then the empirical, which refers to the observations themselves. That is the beginning of Roy Bhaskar's basic critical realism. If we are going to talk about emancipation from capitalism, Roy felt, we have to begin by understanding what exists in the world around us. If we don't know what exists, we can't change it. Okay. The next part of basic critical realism is what Roy referred to as the transformational model of social activity. The transformational model of social activity. What does that mean? Well, that means that to Roy, when we are born into this world, we don't create this world. The world was here before we were here. But acting together with others, we can transform the world anew, meaning we have the ability to help bring about social change, to look at social problems as they exist in the world around us, like COVID, like nuclear proliferation, like racism, like sexism, like social inequality in general. We can look at these social problems and we can say, what can we do to correct them? That is the transformational model of social activity, acting together with others to transform existing conditions of oppression into states of emancipation or liberation from oppression. A non-racist society, a non-sexist society, a non-ableist society, and so on. That's the transformational model of social activity, and ultimately a non-capitalist society, a society based on libertarian communism, as Roy understood it. Okay, that's the basics of basic critical realism. Now, let's go on to the second turn of critical realism, which is dialectical critical realism. In dialectical critical realism, Roy said that there are, again, three different levels to it. As he said in basic critical realism, with the real, the actual, and the empirical. Here, the levels are absence, absenting the absence, and transformation. Let me explain that. In a way, it's kind of a continuation of the transformational model of social activity, but it's kind of an elaboration of it. I look around and I see loads of absences in the world. I see an absence of peace, an absence of love, an absence of security, an absence of patience, an absence of tolerance. Tolerance especially is in very short supply these days, it would seem, especially here in the United States, where we are a very divided country. Those are all absences, things that are missing, that are causing problems. So we work with other people to think, how can we eliminate each of these absences? That's what Roy meant by absenting the absence. Eliminating each one of the absences. Eliminating racism, sexism, capitalism, ageism, ableism, and so on. Eliminating each of them, including ultimately eliminating capitalism. As we eliminate these absences, ultimately we will experience what Roy called transformation, meaning we will live in a transformed society, a society free of those absences. So that is the basic grain or the basic element of dialectical critical realism. There is a lot more to it than that. I am simplifying the whole thing, but that is the basic part of dialectical critical realism. Next, transcendental dialectical critical realism. This was kind of an intermediary turn between dialectical critical realism and the turn that we will talk about after this, called meta-reality. Roy was kind of eccentric. I guess you could say he was eccentric. Around the year 2000, first, let me step back a bit. Roy's father was from India. His mother was from England. And the name Bhaskar is a common Indian last name. And so in the year 2000, Roy thought to himself, you know, I would like to visit India. I've never been to India before. I want to discover my roots, or at least, you know, part of my roots. So he did. He took an extended trip to India, where he met with all sorts of Indian spiritual teachers, masters, gurus of all different types. As a result of that, Roy was transformed himself. He became very spiritual. He was not very spiritual before. He's a nice guy, but he wasn't very spiritual before. Now, all of a sudden, he was very spiritual. So Roy developed transcendental dialectical critical realism as a spiritual version of critical realism. Here, going back to the idea of emancipation, which we discussed before, Roy said that one important way in which we can be emancipated, both as individuals and as societies, is by discovering a certain spiritual practice. For Roy, that was meditation. For other people, Roy said it might be something else. But Roy became very deeply involved in meditation, in a particular type of meditation called Transcendental Meditation, or TM, which I personally have never studied, but I know a bit about. And he felt as though that practice of TM, or Transcendental Meditation, was very important in his life. Roy said that that was a vital ingredient to transforming the world and establishing libertarian communism. So now, to Roy, libertarian communism had a new spiritual dimension to it. It wasn't just freedom from racism, capitalism, sexism. It was freedom from materialism, or a lack of spirituality. And Roy set out to say how we could go about doing that. Okay, now, that particular turn by Roy only lasted 2 years. It was the shortest of Roy's turns or stages. It went from 2000 until 2002. That was it. In 2002, Roy basically took Transcendental Dialectical Critical Realism, a mouthful, and he refined it. He perfected it. He made it more practical. So from 2002 through 2014, which is when Roy died, he developed this new thing, which he called the philosophy of meta-reality. Okay. Now, going back to this idea of three things, there are, again, three different aspects of meta-reality. There is, first, demi-reality. That's D-E-M-I reality, which is like partial or half reality. Then there's relative reality. And finally, there is co-presence. Roy also called co-presence the ground state, non-duality, or sometimes more colorfully, he would call it the cosmic envelope. He would say that we are all a part of this big cosmic envelope. We are all connected with each other. In a sense, the barriers, he said, which exist between all of us are an illusion. We are all connected with each other. Not only with each other, but with all things. The entire universe, which includes human beings, is interconnected. All the aspects of the universe are connected with each other. However, Roy said that we've lost touch with that. And so instead of living in co-presence or the cosmic envelope, we are living in demi-reality, which is disunity. Disunity. Disunity, it's a metaphor. Say I walk into a room. It's a dark room. Very dangerous room. There are landmines in the room. Hand grenades in the room. Trap doors in the floors. And so when I am in that room, my number one objective is, how do I escape this room? Roy said that the world that we live in today is like that. It's like demi-reality, where the world has become very, very dangerous, and we are all trying to find a way to escape from it. The escape is the cosmic envelope. Now, aside from that, there is also what Roy called relative reality, which is simply differences. That's neutral. There are, of course, differences. Roy used the term relative reality to refer to all the stuff that he had done before, such as the transformational model of social activity, the real, the actual, the empirical, absence, absenting absence, and transformation. All of that was a part of relative reality. Now he was interested in this more spiritual thing of how do we get out of this condition of demi-reality where everything is falling apart and where we are in constant danger of death or self-destruction or destruction by somebody else. And again, he felt that the way to do that was by serving others. So he gave up the idea of saying that one needed to have a spiritual practice. He said, if I can help other people to become emancipated from oppression, and if I can become emancipated from oppression myself, then I am gradually going from demi-reality to the cosmic envelope or co-presence. So, again, the ultimate goal of this, to Roy now, was a kind of spiritual libertarian communism, meaning what Roy called liberty, but liberty as a spiritual phenomenon where one is freed of racism and sexism and ageism and nationalism through a kind of spiritual transformation. And that is critical realism in a nutshell, just in a nutshell. If you want to read more about it, you can go to the book I wrote on it, which is at the domain Mark Foster, MarkFoster, .space, MarkFoster.space, and you will find more than you could ever possibly hope on that website. This concludes this lecture. We will conclude Chapter 1 in the Primer book in our next lecture.